Okay, well, anyone with any knowledge of current affairs can see quite clearly the actual inferiority of Muslim countries, the decadence of the states governed by Islam, the intellectual barrenness of the races that derive their culture and education from that religion alone. All those who have travelled to the East or to Africa have been struck by the totally narrow mind of the true believer, the kind of iron band around his head that closes him off completely from science and makes him quite incapable of learning anything or of opening his mind to new ideas. Now, those are not my words. And I have two raffle tickets here, very well-earned raffle tickets, as prizes to anyone who can guess both the person who said that and the year in which it was said, and anyone who helped me with this talk is not eligible for this prize. So would anyone like to hazard a guess?
Huntington,
Churchill. Kipling. No, you're all wrong. And partly I put up my raffle ticket on the basis that no one would guess it. But it was actually the French philosopher Ernest Renan who said it in a speech at the Sorbonne in Paris in 1883. And no guesses that no one got it. But nonetheless, really, I picked an obscure one so I wouldn't have to lose the raffle. But anyway, the reason I wanted to begin with that kind of quote is actually to point out the length of anti-Islam sentiment in the West, that really a lot of people who've been, you know, active in the anti-war movement or movements against racism and anti-Muslim racism in particular can feel like this has been a phenomenon only since 9/11 and all of the racist hysteria which swept the world since then. But really, the length and depth of anti-Islam sentiment across the world has been in existence for quite a long time. And the second reason I wanted to begin with that kind of quote is actually to show that the kind of vile racism towards Muslims that we see across the world today did not just originate in the sort of sensationalist rags of the Herald Sun or from the evil and twisted minds of figures like Andrew Bolt, but is actually got a whole history which is buried deep in some of the most respected institutions of the West, like the Sorbonne. So clearly, Western colonisers and their mouthpieces have long denigrated the people, the culture and the religion of the regions that their rulers have plundered. And given the imperial battles which have been fought over Islamic countries, particularly in the Middle East, it is no wonder that there has been an ocean of ink spilt slandering the people and the religion of Islam and its worshippers. But unfortunately, it's not just been the most right-wing elements of society which have taken up these ideas. Sections of the left have also participated in such slander. Maxime Rodinson, who wrote this book here on Muhammad, also wrote another book, which is the origin of the title of this talk today, Marxism in the Muslim World. And he actually describes how some French leftist scholars from the 1970s, even as early as that, actually claimed that Islam is more dangerous than other religions because it has a greater hold on its believers. Some also claim that Islam is more in harmony with capitalism because it deifies the sort of merchant figure it emerged from a merchant trading class. Others still argue that Islam is a peculiarly feudal ideology and so is more reactionary than Christianity. Others still claim that Islam is less flexible a religion than, again, say, Christianity or Buddhism, and so is much less open to sort of progressive interpretation. And all of these attacks and all of these interpretations, essentially, I want to argue today, amount to a presentation of Islam that is fixed, frozen, and that can only represent one thing, and that one thing is, in essence, backwardness. So what is the starting point for a Marxist understanding of the Muslim world? Well, I would argue that today, in the global context that we find ourselves in, the Marxist beginning has to be to reject much of the racist hyperbole associated with Islam. Some of the talk today will actually be an attempt to rebut some of those sorts of myths that I mentioned above, but really that's not enough because I don't just want to defend or rescue Islam, but I actually want to attempt to give more of an understanding of the Marxist analysis of Islam, so of its rise, of its various different ways in which it's been mobilised by different classes at different times and for different purposes. And in doing so, I hope by the end of the talk, you'll have some sense of the more general Marxist approach to religion. So, hopefully this won't be news to people, but Marxism is not a religious theory. But, like the weekend will have hopefully led you all to believe, Marxism has a lot to say about everything, and in particular, it has a lot to say about religion. Marxism is not anti-religion in a simple sense. Rather, Marxism understands religion as a reflection and an interpretation of society more generally. So religions did not create humanity. Humanity created religion as, in Marx's words, a fantastical interpretation of the world as various classes in society see it and interpret it. And here I actually want to offer a quote from Marx, and I really had to cut down this quote because it's just, it's one of the most sort of beautifully written things that you could read. But anyway, I'll begin with a particular part of it. Man, and you'll have to excuse the gendered language, obviously, is no abstract being squatting outside the world. Man is the world of man, state and society. This state and this society produce religion, which is an inverted consciousness of the world because it is an inverted world. Religion is the general theory of this world, its encyclopedic compendium, its logic in popular form, its spiritual pointer on earth, its enthusiasm, its moral sanction, its solemn component, and its universal basis of consolation and justification. So you can see from that quote that, you know, Marx does not just want to go about sort of condemning religion left, right and centre, but rather he sees religion as an expression of a whole variety of different ways in which the reality of different class forces in society can interpret and look at the world. So Marxism also offers a material explanation for the rise and fall of religions. We argue that religions reflect the class reality of society at any given time, and Islam, it has to be said, in this instance, is no different from Christianity or any other religion, which has been both a state religion, a religion of resistance, an expression of the poor, the rich, the marginal, as well as those at the centre and the top of societies. And so in this sense, Marxism does not just equally condemn all religions, as the sort of popular interpretation of Marx suggests, which does not quote any of those things which I just quoted. The quote which is most often used from Marx about religion is that religion is the opiate of the people, as though it's just this thing which people take, it's pumped into them, it has a soporific effect, and they sort of fall asleep and can't judge the world as it is. Much more than that, though, Marxists say that religion as a whole, or any particular religion, is not simply a delusion that somehow, somewhere, happens to have gripped the minds of millions of people across the world for centuries. Rather, we have to look at the particular historical realities of what any religion are, and I'm going to hope to attempt to do some of that today. So here I want to turn to the very beginnings of Islam to begin to work through some of the implications of a Marxist analysis of the Muslim world. It should also be said at this point, a particular sort of caveat, that I can't talk today about the spread of Islam beyond the Middle East into India, what is now Pakistan, Indonesia, Southeast Asia and so forth. I'm really just going to concentrate on the Muslim world in the Middle East. So again, the Muslim world is a little bit of a misnomer, but I'm just going to talk about the Middle East. So Islam emerged in the trading town of Mecca in what is current day Saudi Arabia in the 7th century. Muhammad, who was the key prophet of Islam and the writer of the Quran, actually grew up as an orphan in one of the less important trading families. And as a young man, he sort of put his hand to a variety of different money-making schemes and enterprises. He didn't do very well in any of them until he actually married a quite wealthy widow and inherited quite a lot of money from her. And it was only, it has to be said, after he became relatively comfortable that Muhammad actually began preaching about his religious revelations. And in many ways, Muhammad's religious thought, as written in the Quran, reflects a lot of the class tensions and contradictions in Meccan society of the time. So by the beginning of the 7th century, Mecca had become a really big, thriving, trading and mercantile city. And religiously, there were a lot of different influences at play. The significant and leading trading families of Mecca at the time were relatively recently settled nomadic groupings who had just come in from the desert. And they held a mixture of sort of polytheistic and animistic beliefs, and their loyalty was really first and foremost to their tribe. And you have to throw into that particular social mix a smaller but still significant section of the population who had been settled for longer and who had converted to Judaism and Christianity over the years. I think it's also worth noting that the dominant empires of the time were both monotheistic. So there was the Persian Empire, which was Zoroastrian, and the Byzantine Empire, which was Christian. And that I really think that given the dominance of those empires, the fact that the religions of these empires were monotheistic must have affected the sort of attitudes and beliefs that people sort of had about their strength and power and how they sort of managed to maintain that in a way. Meccan society was riven with divisions. There was divisions between the classes, so between the merchants, between the traders, between the producers, the urban poor, and the nomads. And then there were also divisions within the classes. So particularly within the mercantile classes, there were divisions between the major families of the time. And then also there were divisions between Meccan society and the dominant empires of the time as well. Muhammad keenly felt the turmoil in society, and the religion that he developed was in many ways a response to the sort of turmoil that he saw around him. Muhammad's preachings were a simultaneous expression of the ideas of Muslim mercantilism, a critique of the big merchant families and the aspirations of a more powerful Meccan and Arabian mercantilism. So, for instance, the virtues which the Quran upholds are the virtues of a good, stable and socially conscious merchant trader. And so you can just run through a few of them. There's the avoidance of wasteful consumption, to be honest in one's dealings, not to indulge in drinking and gambling, to avoid in extramarital sexual relations, so, you know, to preserve the sanctity of the family, to enter into written trade agreements, to give charity to the poor. But all of that is not just the sum total of Muhammad's thought. He was, it has to be said, absolutely appalled by the extent of the class divisions and poverty in Meccan society. He saw that the levels of unhappiness and destitution amongst the Meccan poor, while absolutely appalling, could also be destabilising for society as a whole. So in the part of the Quran which was actually written in Mecca, and there were two parts of it, one which was written in Mecca and one which was written in Medina, Muhammad actually rails against the rich and their greed, but instead, and this is interesting to note, but instead of arguing for social revolution, and there have been other mystics and social figures and religious figures in history who've actually argued for social revolution, Muhammad instead argues for the rich to provide charity to help alleviate the degradation of the poor. But the fact that he made those attacks, the fact that, you know, some of them are actually quite vitriolic, gave him the capacity to pull in behind his new religious movement a lot of the urban, poor, and some sections of the mainly young, more dissatisfied urban mercantile elements. Muhammad's preaching also revealed the desire for a unifying religious ideology, a monotheistic religion which could actually try and rise above some of the tribal affiliations. And it took much from Christianity and Judaism. And actually, you know, if you read through the Quran, there are whole sections and figures from Christianity and Judaism who then appear again in the Quran. Significantly, however, Islam, as preached by Muhammad, was also a political program for reforming society. So it aimed to replace the often armed competition between tribes and ruling families with an ordered ummah, or a community, based on a single code of laws rather than a whole series of sort of fractious family groupings which were, you know, constantly at battle and war with each other. And so in that sense, actually, the Quran is quite unlike a series of other religious documents throughout history in that it actually argues for a political, strategy for governing society. And it has to be said that many of those sort of political dictates challenged the status quo of the time. It challenged the sort of Meccan dominant families of the period. And so that element of Islam, the sort of political dynamic of the early part of what Muhammad was preaching, was the thing that sort of strangely enough gave it support and made it quite popular from some sections of the more far-sighted merchants across the region. But it was also that element, the element which sort of urged social upheaval, a change to the structure of Meccan society, which made it quite popular, quite unpopular amongst the Meccan, the ruling families of Mecca. And so actually, Muhammad had to flee Mecca, and he went to a town, nearby town called Medina. And it was in Medina, actually, that Muhammad received a much warmer, welcome from the local families. He sort of cut and managed to convince a few of the local, both landowning families and merchant families, to follow him and to join him. And after a period of time, Islam actually became the religion of a new Medinan state. In AD 630, Muhammad launched a major offensive against the Meccan elite, conquering them with forces that he'd built up in Medina later in that year. And after conquering Mecca, Muhammad and his two successors, or caliphs, built up a strong army and a strong state. The weakening of the Persian and Byzantine Empire actually meant that the Islamic empire's armies, rather, were able to rapidly extend their power. So one by one, key cities across the Middle East were taken. From Damascus in 636, the Persian capital of Ctesiphon in 637, the Egyptian city of Babylon, which is now part of Cairo, in 639, and Alexandria in 642. So really, you can get a sense of the immense expansion within just 10 years. And so within that decade, really, they'd managed to create a massive empire out of the lands and historic civilizations of the Middle East. And so that brief account, it's not just sort of to inform you all, to give you a nice sort of history, but the point of going through all of that in some detail is to give you a sense of the different classes that over a period of time Islam could come to represent. So it developed from being the preaching of a marginalised young merchant, to the religion of a state, to Medina, to the religion of a strong, outwardly expanding empire, an empire which sought to codify the rights and desires of a mercantile trading class and to allow the development of their wealth and power more broadly across the region and across the world. But it also has to be said that while that was actually the initial class basis of the expansion of Islam, it also, because of sort of facts on the ground in some ways of Islamic power, became the religion of choice amongst many of the great landowners of the Middle East. So you can start to get a sense of the sort of many different classes then that Islam started to represent. But before I sort of move on, I actually wanted to deal more specifically with some of the arguments that I mentioned before, that there is something more inherently reactionary or backwards in Islam that means, as the quote at the start said, that there is an iron band around the head of anyone who believes in Islam, and that has been since its very origins, that cuts them off to science and scientific thinking and rational development. So, to begin with, such claims, I would argue, are just not historically viable. Indeed, if you were living in the Middle Ages, such claims would seem absolutely ludicrous, as this was a time when European Christian, or the Christian world, was actually living mired in poverty and degradation, and the Islamic Empire was a flourishing centre of rational thought, of scientific innovation, and artistic experimentation. And here, I think it's worth giving just a brief account of some of that history because, it's so outside of the dominant ways in which any of us here in Australia or, much of the Western world hears about Islam and any of its history. The dominant Western narrative, and one which, I was brought up on in school and which I'm sure many people here would be familiar with, actually suggests that after the fall of the Roman Empire in the late 5th century, really, the lights went out, and the entire world was plunged into a cultural and scientific backwardness from which it really only emerged 1,000 years later with the joys and the delicacies of the Renaissance in Italy. But I would argue that that sort of mythology totally obscures the period between 700 and 1400 CE, which has been known across the Muslim world as the Golden Age of Islam. And during that period, there were huge developments in scientific and mathematical thinking. And again, I don't think this is anything particularly to do with, you know, the progressiveness of Islam, but much more to do with the sort of social dynamics which were emerging in the Islamic Empire at the time. So by 661, the task of Islam had actually changed dramatically. For the first few decades after Muhammad had died, the new Muslims had really been terribly preoccupied with a whole series of battles against the Persian and Byzantine empires. But by 661, these battles had largely been fought and won, and the priorities of the caliphate began to change and develop. And these sorts of developments, which sort of changed to much more administering a fairly huge empire, the likes of which I described earlier, actually required the development of quite a significant administrative infrastructure. So, for instance, they needed better banking systems. They needed a more literate population. They needed a language which could enable the easier and smoother running of the affairs of the state, and thus Arabic came to be spoken much more from Andalusia to Afghanistan. And those sorts of developments in language also enabled a much more significant cross-cultural, scientific and cultural fertilisation. So similarly, an empire which was as devoted to banking and finance as the sort of early Islamic empire was, actually required mathematics. And this all required some real mathematical advances, and there's whole books on this, and I'm not really mathematically minded, so I couldn't tell you whether they're advances or, you know, not advances, but you know, I sort of took that they were, and there was, you know, there was a lot of good things that happened then, but I thought one of the excellent things which sort of showed the massive development of the Islamic empire and the, you know, cultural sort of developments which happened over the time was that the banking system was actually so advanced that you could, in, and this is again in the 8th century, that you could actually make a checkout in somewhere like Baghdad and have it cashed in Cordoba in the south of Spain. So, you know, it gives you a sense of the, you know, in some ways like massive development of the period around some of those things. The expansion of the empire also required shifting the capital from the fringes of the empire, Mecca, to somewhere more central and culturally significant. So one of the first major caliphates actually shifted their empire from Mecca to Damascus. And this centre of empire actually changed, you know, over a period of time according to the dominant sort of political dictates of, you know, who was the head family at any given time. But in 1813, the centre shifted from Damascus to Baghdad, where it remained into the 10th century. And I just wanted to say something briefly about Baghdad, because it was probably one of the most fated Islamic cities for about 200 years. And I just wanted to include this because I think, you know, when we see on the news nightly, or not so nightly anymore, but the sort of rubble that Baghdad is today, it can be very difficult to imagine it as the centre of an entire world. And, you know, from what I've read, it was really a very cosmopolitan city. It was a city of glamour. It was a city of excitement. It was sort of, from what I can tell, a medieval New York, that it was sort of the place where everyone wanted to go, you know, where dreams would be made. And within a few decades of its founding in 762, it had grown into one of the world's greatest cities. Estimates suggest that it actually had a population of up to 1 million at a time when few cities outside of China had anything more than a few tens of thousands. And people of all religions came from far and wide to Baghdad. And if you read something like the 1001 Arabian Nights, apart from all the saucy bits, you get a sense of what the mystique of the city was like for traders, for artisans, for philosophers, for mathematicians, for doctors, from right across the empire. So Baghdad also significantly became a centre for translation from Greek, from Syriac, from Indian, from philosophy, from medicine, from mathematics. And here the Abbasid Caliphate, which was the first Shia Caliphate, desiring to sort of give their own rule more legitimacy, actually funded a huge amount of such translation into Arabic. And really, many of the sort of very important classical works that, you know, anyone who, you know, studies classics today would know from a whole variety of Greek and Roman philosophers and thinkers, the only reason these texts are in existence today is because they were translated from Greek or, you know, Roman or Latin rather, into Arabic and then translated back, you know, into English or Latin later on. So, while Christians in Western Europe were burning these books and hunting down heresies, across the Islamic Empire, really levels of intellectual inquiry were being celebrated. But again, I don't think this is just something inherent in Islam that made all of this more or less possible. Actually, why any of this could happen at this particular historical moment in history comes down to the way in which the Islamic Empire was developing, the ways in which the particular leaders of those empires wanted to present themselves to the world, to justify their own rule, to give themselves some sort of cultural and intellectual heritage, and so forth. And so, really, we can't just see any of these sorts of developments, again, as being separated off from the society in which they were developing, as emerging in particular from, you know, the sort of religious ideas from which, you know, which dominated at the time. So before moving on, I really want to say something briefly about the treatment of women in Islam, as, again, this is one of the most regularly raised slanders against the religion. The situation of women in Islam has been cynically used by imperialists to justify the invasion and plunder of countries like Afghanistan and Iraq. And we would all be very, very familiar with the crocodile tears that George Bush and Laura Bush and, you know, similar folks across the world cried over the treatment of women in Afghanistan under the Taliban. But, you know, clearly the American invasion, it has to be said, has killed thousands of women and ruined the lives of hundreds of thousands of more. And that is what makes this particular attack so hypocritical and vile. But much of the Western hysteria about the backwardness of Islam with regards to women, well, clearly it's, you know, hysteria and justification for imperialist plunder, usually also involves a very patronizing attitude towards Muslim women as though they're just the victims of historical circumstance. They couldn't possibly have a political opinion in their head. They couldn't possibly be anything more than a veil which is covering their face or their head. But more than that, I would argue that these attitudes usually involve a fairly uncritical attitude towards women's oppression in the West. But condemning the hypocritical nature of much of the hysteria about women in Muslim countries does not, of course, deny that women are oppressed in Muslim countries, and in some places, very brutally so. But again, I would argue that the oppression of women in these countries does not originate from the religion. Rather, it comes from the general social requirements of that particular society, of the requirements of the ruling class in those particular countries at any given time, and again, do not simply flow from some particular, you know, verse in the Quran that these people happen to have just picked out, you know, and decided, you know, matters religiously. Marxists actually recognise that women have been oppressed in all class societies, not just the ones where their religion is Islam. Indeed, on a sort of side note, there is some evidence that given the influence of traditional nomadic or Bedouin traditions in Mecca during the time of Muhammad, women are actually accorded slightly more rights in the Quran than for the Christian women of the day. So, for instance, women have property rights in the Quran, whereas women in the Christian Bible of the time were accorded no such rights, and as soon as they married, basically had to forfeit all of their own property. But again, the point of saying those things is not to point out that one religion is somehow better with regards to women, but the notion that there is something inherently more reactionary in Islam is absurd. Religions themselves, the ideas, the writings, the books, all of these things did not create the oppressive human relationships in class society, but they've actually functioned historically to enforce ideology which strengthens already existing inequalities within the social order. Okay, to return to some of the other arguments that get put. One is that Islam is such a rigid religion that there is no possibility for some movement of the oppressed to take up Islam as its banner. So there's some people who actually suggest that there's no possibility for something within Islam like liberation theology, for instance, which, you know, has emerged in Latin American countries around Christianity. And again, I would argue that these arguments are just plain unhistorical. Since almost the very inception of Islam, oppressed sections of society have rallied under its banner. One of the most famous of these movements emerged as early as the Fourth Caliphate. And this rebellion was made up of desert Bedouin who were hostile to the political and economic development of the Islamic Empire, which saw them relegated to the lower ranks of the army, kept out of the state structure, and shut out of any rapid accumulation of wealth. They also felt that the development of the Islamic Empire had transformed Islam from a more simple, egalitarian religion to a justification for a bloated governmental bureaucracy. And this movement was named the Seceders or the Karajites, and it spread quite far. It spread from the Arabian Peninsula right down to North Africa and the Berbers, who actually took up the ideas with a real vengeance. And another really exciting example that, you know, I sort of wanted to give more because it was really exciting than anything else, but is actually of the Zanj revolt of black slaves, which shook the Abbasid Empire for 14 years, from 869 to 883. In the Islamic Empire, surplus wealth was got from the peasantry, from trade, as well as for the time, some quite large-scale agricultural enterprises. And these great business ventures actually led to the gathering together of tens of thousands of slaves from across the whole of the region, together in huge agricultural enterprises. And one of these was a huge salt marsh complex to the east of Basra, which is in modern-day Iraq. Hundreds of thousands of slaves were employed in this particular enterprise for draining the salt marshes in order to use the lands later to, you know, they drained the salt to sell the salt, but also to use the land for agricultural operations. And clearly, as the way that most slaves are treated across the world, their conditions were absolutely appalling and drove the slaves, who, interestingly to note, most of whom were not initially Muslim as they were sort of gathered from a variety of different places across the empire and plonked together in this particular place. They were organised in this complex by a figure called Ali B. Muhammad, who preached the deliverance of the slaves through rebellion and adherence to a particularly sort of occult form of Islam. And here, Islam clearly offered, despite most of these slaves not having been Muslim beforehand, Islam offered a common language which all of the slaves could be gathered, regardless of their particular background. And by returning to the letter of the Quran, the Zanj rebellion could actually form a sort of argument that these slaves could put to the rulers of the time that, you know, actually gave them some moral legitimacy in a way. So they could sort of say, well, you say you're Muslim, and you say that all Muslims should be treated equally in your realm, yet look at us. We're not treated well. And so actually we're the true inheritors of Islam. And so that whole particular argument was in some ways a way of giving them some political legitimacy for their struggle. Now, again, on a particularly interesting note, one of the most remarkable things about this rebellion was how long it lasted, but also how it spread. Some of the black troops, which were actually sent to crush the rebellion from the empire, which sort of had gathered a whole range of other sort of mercenary armies and slave forces to come and crush it, instead of crushing it, these forces actually decided to join it. And so they joined the rebellion. And even some of the free peasants around the region also joined the revolt. And by AD 1870, after capturing the seaport of Abula and then expanding it southwest into Persia, these forces then came back and managed to capture Basra itself. Eventually, however, the movement was crushed by forces sort of, you know, obviously the state forces were much stronger than them. But again, I think it's important to show that these examples demonstrate that Islam could be a language that was taken up by these forces of rebellion, and be made in some ways to express, the dissatisfaction with society that these people felt. In more recent times, we've obviously also seen a vast array of movements against imperialism across the Middle East, and these movements have taken on an Islamic colouring in a whole variety of ways. So from Hezbollah in Lebanon to Hamas in Palestine to the Muslim Brotherhood in the Middle East, in Egypt. And these movements have fought against the military and political dominance of the big imperial powers of the day. But, like the Karajites and the Zanj slaves, the social and class hostilities of the people involved, not just the religious ideas, really are the motivating force here. Again, a quick note. While Marxists might defend these movements of the oppressed, which sort of wrap themselves in the flavours and colours of Islam, we do not actually argue that these religious ideas are enough to genuinely defeat imperialism and ultimately to get rid of class society. So the point of pointing out these examples is not just to say that Islam is a perfect example, a perfect language for resistance, but rather to suggest that historically, movements of the oppressed use whichever ideologies available to them as a particular rallying point. The social composition of the movements is actually the key to understanding them, not just the expressions or the language that they use or the religious justifications that they mobilise at any given time. So, just as Islam has been used as a voice of resistance by the oppressed and the marginalised right throughout the entire history of Islam, it has also been a state religion, a justification for intensely brutal and anti-human practices. And here I want to skip forward a few centuries and arrive at the late 19th and early 20th century to look at the relationship between Wahhabism and the Saudi ruling family as a very clear example of where a particular branch of Islam, Wahhabism, has been mobilised not at all for a liberatory end, but as a religious justification for a brutal and repressive state structure. So, at the beginning of the 20th century, Arabia was an absolute wasteland. In comparison to other, centres across the Middle East like Turkey or Egypt, the Arabian Peninsula was incredibly economically, politically and socially underdeveloped. Capitalism had, by and large, bypassed the region. So the cities were small and the society was dominated by warring, desert, nomadic families. But some of that began to change at the beginning of the First World War, when the various different sort of competing imperial interests across the world began to take a particular interest in the Arabian Peninsula and recognised its sort of strategic importance in a whole variety of sort of imperial machinations, which I don't have time to go into. But those particular imperial powers began to develop and foster relationships with some of the ruling families of the time. One of the most prominent of these families was the Al Saud family in this particular part of the region. And this interest was really intensified massively by the discovery of massive oil deposits. And the Al Saud family, aided by the British, fought a series of very bloody battles throughout the 1920s and into the 1930s to unite, this sort of euphemistic term, to unite the various provinces on the Arabian Peninsula. And in 1932, the modern-day Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was announced. In uniting these various provinces, defeating the local sort of fairly restive populations and bringing them all under Saudi control with British and then with American backing, as well as maintaining their excessive wealth, and really it is excessive, the Saudi royal family required some sort of cohesive ideological glue. And here Wahhabism fitted like a glove. And it was a religion which was both promoted, it has to be said, by the Saudi ruling family, but also by the so-called civilized Western forces who are now, triumphant across the world, saying, the sorts of things that we talked about earlier. So Wahhabis are the followers of Ibn Abdul Wahhab, who lived in the 1700s and developed a reform movement which declared the necessity of returning to a very strict and literal interpretation of the Quran. Wahhabism began its long-lasting relationship with the Saudi family in the 1700s when Wahhab converted one of the greatest notables of the region, Muhammad Ibn Saud, who married his daughter and so began the sort of hereditary dynasty which has been the Wahhabite dynasty. And so what were some of the ideas which enabled the sort of development of this quite strong Saudi state? Well, one of the key ideas that Wahhabism puts forward is that the whole purpose of the Muslim community is to become the living embodiment of God's laws. And it's the responsibility of the legitimate ruler, which is, of course, the Saudi family, to ensure that people know God's laws and that they live in conformity with them. So God's laws are enforced by, not by individuals just discovering these laws, obviously. They're enforced by the Commission for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice, which is actually a state police religious unit established in the 40s with the task of enforcing Sharia as defined by the Saudi ruling family. And what is that Sharia? It includes, amongst other things, the power to arrest anyone engaged in homosexual acts, in prostitution, in fornication, or the proselytization of non-Muslim religions. They can also arrest unrelated males and females caught socializing, enforce Islamic dress codes, Muslim dietary laws, and store closures during the prayer times. And almost needless to say, independent trade unions are banned according to, this as well. And these ideas, I think, again, don't just come because, somehow, the Saudi ruling family just read it in the Quran and decided, oh, this is the best way of practicing. These ideas actually gave a perfect religious justification for the House of Saud as both an aspiring ruling class before the 1920s and then afterwards as they needed to build up a strong central capitalist state to both unify all of the previously fractious tribes and then to modernise rapidly. And this actually meant that it was both necessary to discipline sections of the wealthy that might not want to conform with his Saudi dominance, and it was also necessary to discipline the emerging working class, to both intimidate and to provide some sort of religious justification for the particularly repressive nature of Saudi rule, so as to, and we have to be clear here, I think, so as to enable a super profitable Saudi capitalist kingdom. And again, this example points to the way that Islam has worked hand in glove with the development of a particular ruling class at a particular point in history. And so it also shows how a repressive Islam, far from being antithetical to capitalism, as some people have argued, actually grew up as a, intertwined with it. And these examples, I would argue, actually operate against the fairly romantic notion of some people who want to defend Islam, that Islam is necessarily more progressive than other religions. So to conclude, to talk about Islam as though it's just one homogenous body of thought is absolutely ludicrous. Just like Christianity, Islam has been taken up by a variety of different classes of people in a variety of different historical moments. And to return to the quote from Marx at the very beginning of the talk, and it's a line which I absolutely love, humanity does not squat outside the world, picking and choosing from ideas regardless of their social relationships. Religious ideas, just like political ideas, are informed by the social and historical context that people find themselves in. There is no other explanation for the multiple interpretations of Islam over the centuries. So rather than blame Islam, or to celebrate it for that matter, as the origin of all that is either good or bad about the world we live in, we rather have to look at the class relationships that underlie and inform religious ideas and motivations. Any other approach, I would argue, leads up the very thorny idealist path of understanding religion as the cause rather than the expression of social problems. And so for Marxists, we don't want to just fight religious ideas or just to celebrate them. We actually want to argue that to take on, the underlying dynamics of society is the key thing. And so I want to end with a quote from Marx that says, "The criticism of heaven turns into a criticism of earth. The criticism of religion into the criticism of law. And the criticism of theology into a criticism of politics." And again, I think that really encapsulates what the Marxist approach in general should be to religious ideas and to the Muslim world more specifically.